This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 29 of What's It Like. My guest is Karen Pryor, best known for her clicker training. Hey, Karen, how are you?
Hi, Ken. I'm fine, thank you.
Around the world, this sound is well known for training horses and dogs and cats. And is there an animal that you haven't trained?
Well, there's animals I haven't trained because I haven't run into them yet. And really, my job, Ken, is to train trainers with the click like that. My job is to teach the technology and help it develop and spread because it's so powerful and so interesting and so much fun. But I do get to train some unusual animals that I've had no experience with now and then because I'm working with other people. So once in a while I get to play with a rhinoceros, or I get to teach. And I think one of the interesting things that you can do with a clicker is work with a sports coach and teach them how to use the clicker when it's a sport you don't know anything about.
Yes.
So I've worked with tennis coaches and golf coaches and so forth, and everybody's always amazed at how this incompetent duffer of a student standing in front of us suddenly gets better and better right in front of us. And I didn't know what they were teaching, but the coach knows what he wants or she wants. They just don't know how to break it down right.
It's interesting that how late the application has been for humans.
Yes, it comes very, very slowly. And we have been teaching the applications for human beings, my company and my team and my colleagues. Well, we've been doing that formally for about 10 years using this sound or another different sound, any different sound, not the click because the click's for dogs, everybody knows that, but picking another sound and using that for people. But it is a very slow sell. It's a very slow sell.
Can it be, or does it have to have a particular parameter to it?
Yes, that's an interesting sound that you made, but it would not make a good marker because it's too long in time. It happens, it takes too long to start and finish. You need, because you want to isolate exactly what the muscles are doing at the moment that the golfer is in that backswing, or the dog catches your eye, or the rhino begins to move backwards, which can be a slow business for a rhino.
Mm-hmm.
You want to catch the muscles in action. And that takes, because you're really talking to the whole nervous system, not just the conscious mind of the learner. And for that, you want it to be breathtakingly short, with a sharp attack and a sharp decay. The click is actually, I wouldn't say it's an ideal sound because it's a two-beat sound.
Yes.
But where that seems to be working in our favor is that the two-beat makes it distinct from all other clicks and cracks and funny noises that happen. And the first part of the click is the part that catches the behavior.
Ah.
So does work.
Are humans opposed to using clicks for themselves?
Well, some of them are because they associate it with animal training. But mostly I think it's our hubris.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that we're so sure that what we say is more important than anything else.
Yes.
And that our golden words are all that a learner needs to know is to listen to what we say and then do it, and then that ought to work. Well, actually, we often say far too much, or we aren't clear, and it doesn't work if you're dealing with a kind of nonverbal situation, like a dance move. So I don't know why it's taking so long. I think part of it is also the still ever-present objection to Skinner.
Right.
And that's a matter of some historical interest, how that became, that prejudice just became so strong. I think largely a religious issue in the 40s and 50s, but it hasn't died out. I think my next book ought to be called, guess what, Skinner was right.
Or at least Skinner wasn't all wrong.
No, he wasn't all wrong at all. He was right. Most of the things that people fuss about are things that either never happened at all or were done by followers of his.
Yes. Now, you met Skinner, didn't you?
I did, and I'm great friends with both of his daughters. His older daughter, Julie, lives right near me here in Cambridge, and We probably see each other once a week, and she and her husband constitute my my scientific source for going back to the basics. You know, that when I need to check on something, boy, they know, because they were raised in that tradition, all right.
Where were you raised?
Oh, all over the place. My father was a writer, so when I was little, I lived in New York and France and Hollywood when he was writing for the movies, and Florida when I was older, but mostly in the Northeast. I was born in New York City.
How did your parents impact your worldview?
Well, considerably. They were divorced when I was six, and so they impacted my worldview separately.
Hmm.
But my mother was an artist. She never picked up a paintbrush, but she was very visual, very creative, and a great naturalist. She herself had been born to immigrant farmers, came from Hungary in the turn of the century, and settled in Hartford, Connecticut. And my mother, Sally, was the oldest of their children and didn't speak English until she went to school. But she was a fine naturalist, and I think very early on, even when I was very small, she taught me the plants and the birds and so forth around the neighborhood, around our country farmhouse, and she encouraged my great interest in the natural sciences. And my father also was very interested in, as well as writing, he was an early conservationist and an ardent fisherman, and he and my stepmother were also very good amateur naturalists and encouraged me in that whole area.
When you were growing up, did you have a major challenge in school, or did it come naturally to you?
I was clever, Ken, and schoolwork came fairly easy. A major challenge would be the multiplication table.
Mm-hmm.
I did not understand why I should do all this boring memorization, nor what use I would ever have for this tool in later life, and so I never learned them. I flunked third grade arithmetic, and it hasn't bothered me. This is the first time since you asked. I would say that without wanting to ignore all of mathematics, there are other things that are quite interesting. Wherever it veers into the area of logic, mathematics makes a lot of sense, and is very interesting. Where it stays in computation, I have simply ignored it all my life. There are now, luckily, we have machines for that.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Did you have a fun childhood?
Of course, but it was a complicated childhood. I was sent away to school when I was seven.
Mm.
My mother remarried, and it wasn't convenient for them to have a child around all the time. So I was placed with the principal of a small school in New Haven, Connecticut, and lived with her until I was 14, except in the summers, and then I visited my mother. So that wasn't a normal upbringing, but it was a very nice upbringing because Mrs. Sturley, the English woman who raised me, was also interested in many of the things I was interested in, and we were very companionable. She knew how to take care of a child, which was a good thing.
Sort of an extended family.
Yes, I have more parents than most people. I ended up with quite a few.
Now that you've survived childhood, what constitutes family for you?
Well, I've been married twice for 20 years each time, so I can say I've been married for 40 years, but to two different people. I have three children, and they are all happily married, and they all have children of their own, so I have seven grandchildren, some of whom are all grown up now, college age.
Oh, wow.
And then lots of friends, and boy, do I know a lot of dog trainers. And my company, I have started this company some years ago just to publish books, and now we have teach people to train animals, and we teach the people who work with we teach quite a few people who work with children with autism and other kinds of here's where operant conditioning and shaping and reinforcement come in very handy. All kinds of nonverbal positive tools work great with these kids.
How did you get into animal training or operant conditioning?
Oh, I came across, that would have been in 1963. my husband got out. We were living in Hawaii where the Marine Corps had sent us. And my husband got out of school and started going to graduate school in marine zoology. And that was partly just because of following my interests in natural history and underwater life. We'd done a lot of diving, and that interested him too. And at some point, he decided what he really wanted to do was build his own research facility. And to do that, he would build a public oceanarium, an attraction for Hawaii. And so he entrepreneured and built Sea Life Park in Hawaii, which was and is a big public attraction with a research institute side by side, which is still flourishing. And 3 months before the place was due to open, it became apparent we were going to have dolphin shows because that was the thing you needed to bring the tourist industry in, and the tourists were going to have to be our bread and butter. So we had these dolphins, and we had a new scientific way been given to us by one of our advisors, a little manual on how to train animals by this new system called operant conditioning. And the park was about to open. It was 3 months from opening, and they had no shows. They had the trainers. Presumably any intelligent person could read this guide and train a dolphin. Now, you know, that's true. In a way. Skinner was right, see. I mean, if you understand the simple, basic rules of operant work, you can train anything. It doesn't matter what it is. You don't have to push it around. You don't have to impress it. You don't have to scare it or be dominant or any of that stuff. You just have to have something the animal wants and a safe place to stand on, and the animal has to have a safe place to be on, too. So through the bars, from land to water, it doesn't matter. However, the little 12-page typescript that we had, or whatever it was the trainers that we had hired did not understand it. And essentially, the dolphins had trained the trainers to give them fish for nothing. So there was no show, and there was no... So I was asked to step in for three reasons. One, I was the only person who had ever trained anything. I had trained a dog, and I had trained a horse, one each. And secondly, I was right there. I was available and I was interested. And third, I was the boss's wife, so I would be expected to take no salary. I come cheap.
All good qualifications.
Yeah, exactly. And so when I read and I didn't want to work. I had three little children. I was helping with the project by, you know, giving dinner for visiting investors and stuff, but I knew it would be difficult to take on a job, and I knew I didn't want to work for my husband. I just saw that was going to be a problem, which it was. But I know I read this description about operant conditioning, and from my own experience, that dog and that horse, I understood it, and I couldn't wait to try it. I just had to try this. It was so exciting. And these dolphins were perfect sample animals. I mean, most of the research work had been done with rats and with pigeons.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fine. You can measure what they do. You can get a lot of them going at the same time, and they're fine. But what I had here was something more workable not because they were so smart. That helps. That's nice. It's not necessary. You can do an awful lot with rats and pigeons, too. That they were so big. And the medium of exchange was fish, was food.
Mm-hmm.
And these animals would eat 20, 30 pounds of fish a day. Oh, my goodness, you could make a lot of training mistakes before they filled up. So that gave me a chance to, and it gave me a tremendous learning situation. All these animals to play with and two or three people to help thaw the fish and stuff. We did have some help. And so I dived in, and I have basically never climbed out of that dolphin tank since. It's just that the species of animals change, and lots of times now it's people.
Were you the first to work with dolphins?
Oh, no. But there were nobody. But since, how do I explain this? There were dolphins in captivity. That started after World War II. There were several oceanariums now at that point in the early 60s. There were three of them. Marineland of the Pacific in California, Marine Studios in Florida, and Seaquarium in Miami. And SeaWorld, which is now the biggest and most, biggest one in most different parks around the country, SeaWorld mm-hmm. was just starting. They started, they opened, I think, somewhat after we did. And so they were just starting up. We were the first to have operant training, any to start with. Before that, most of the trainers were sea lion trainers, and they came from a circus tradition. So really waving fish around to make the animal jump, luring them in the air and throwing fish to make them go farther away and so forth. They have, you know, they didn't have a lot of tools mm-hmm. for training the animals.
It's like operant conditioning without precision.
Oh, yeah. And with not only that, without any idea of where to begin if you wanted to control a behavior at the distance or something like that. They really just didn't have any tools at all other than what they could lure.
Right.
Which is prompt-based training. And that means you got to have the animal over here looking at you, waiting for the prompt, and you can only get behavior that you can physically prompt.
Yes.
Right, which the animal, and these animals, of course, capable of a great deal more than that. So we now had a marker so we could catch any behavior the animal happened to do, from squeaking at you to double backflip. You know, if it happened, we could capture it, then we had it, then we could bring it under stimulus control. So,
what did you use as your marker?
A whistle, police whistle.
Oh.
That was suggested to us by the graduate student who made our little manual. And it does have a very good advantage in that it's loud underwater, too. Even if you're blowing it in the air, you can hear it underwater.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we used. The clicker didn't come along for 20 years, maybe more, actually more like 30 years. So anyway, dolphin trainers all over the world use the whistle. It's fun to see how fast in something like this traditions develop. And that's one of them. You train dolphins with whistles. Everybody knows that. Actually, you can train them just fine with a clicker because the clicker sounds, you can put the clicker, if you put your hand in the water, that click carries like anything underwater.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Uh-huh. So we've used that to train swimmers.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Now that you've developed training techniques and systems for helping people learn this, what do you exactly do?
Oh, you mean what do I do? Well, I'm a writer, you know, and every 10 years I crank out another important book, and in between I do an awful lot of other kinds of writing, from scientific papers to articles on the web. I keep the writing going pretty heavily. My most recent book is called Reaching the Animal Mind.
Yes.
And it's a book about my own experiences working with clicker training, and more than that, seeing how animals think, because this really opens up the animal's ability to communicate back. And when you are moving with them, following them, as it were, rather than leading them and bossing them around, you have a great chance to see their minds really ticking over. And so I wanted to share some of those experiences. And that book is a book of stories about animals learning, and me too. What I do on a daily basis is I run a company called KPCT, Karen Pryor's Clicker Training. I have a business partner, and together we have built this company into a very much a going concern. I'm responsible for some of the training and thinking and development side. We have about 15 people on staff here, and then we have another, oh gosh, we've got 300 certified trainers around the country who just the dog people. The dog instructors that we've developed and brought to what we consider a really good level and certified as good instructors as well as good teachers of people as well as of the animals. And we have a lot of people working in zoos, and we work with the autism community. And I come to work 3 half-days a week or 4 half-days a week. I do quite a lot of traveling because once Reaching the Animal Mind came out, I found myself getting a lot of speaking invitations, especially from the academic community. So I do more of that than I used to. For a long time, I stopped doing that in order to build a company. We give 2 big conferences a year, different cities every year, and those are quite a production. So we spend a certain amount of time. I might, for example, in March, I had to go down to Tennessee and look at a hotel to see if it was going to be big enough to handle our next year's conference. And then another month I might be traveling to give a paper at a scientific conference or to do an overview of some of our faculty who are teaching our graduates. Basically it's a mixed job, but now I'm a grandmother, I can pick my own workload.
What's the best thing about your job?
Oh, it's different every day, and the people. You know, I have a wonderful time with all the people I get to work with. It's a joy. And I'm still very curious and interested about the trainer, about the other people. You know, a lot of reading online, too, because we have some very active lists everybody shares. This morning, we got an email on our faculty list. That's the people that teach our teachers, from a woman who trains search and rescue dogs, and she is one of our teachers as well. Search and rescue people are very conservative, and they sometimes don't think the dogs are worth the trouble. There's actually some opposition. You know, it's like gaslight is good enough for me. I don't see why we need this newfangled electricity.
Mm-hmm.
We've never done it with dogs. I don't see why we need dogs. So she was called in on a search for a man who might have committed suicide in Denver, in the mountains, in the snow. They had found his car, but there was a foot of new snow everywhere. And they'd assembled a team of 30 people to start combing the area in every direction on what they assumed might be a two-day search. It took the dog 35 or 40 minutes to find the guy. He was there. He had done himself in. And without a dog, who knows how long that would have taken. So it's very not only a clicker-trained dog, but a clicker rescue. A Belgian Malinois who was so high-keyed and so excitable that probably would not have made it. You know, it was a dog that really needed to be handled right so that it would calm down enough to work. So she was telling us about that, and another day would be something completely different. Another one that just came in to me this morning was a woman who's working in Montana. It's a research study of a very rare lizard, and her dog's trained to smell out just those lizards.
Wow.
In the wild.
Mm-hmm.
Clickers gives you, first of all, an enthusiastic animal that's initiative, that's bringing its own initiative to the job, so you can ask it to do complex things. And then a dog that you can ask for very precise information because it understands what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of their field biologists using dogs for tracking snow leopards and all kinds of amazing animals around the world. Finding a rare species of animal just by finding its droppings as distinguished from all the other kinds of droppings in the woods. This is beyond, you know, making sure that your pet behaves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nice to see. It's nice to see.
I have more questions for Karen Pryor right after I remind you of the good work done by the American Red Cross. If you ever need an operation, you'll be glad people have donated their blood to help you. So I want to remind you to give blood and to donate to the American Red Cross. They've been doing good for a long time. When my parents were prisoners of war, one of the things that saved their lives was a package they got from the American Red Cross. Somewhere in the world today, there are people you can help through the Red Cross. And don't forget to get prepared yourself for emergency situations. Go to the store and check out their personal safety emergency pack. Do yourself a favor and give to the American Red Cross. Go to redcross.org. Thanks. So, Karen, everyone has to give themselves self-motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Well, I never do it with punishment. Actually, the problem is never, what shall I do? Oh, ho, hum, I don't have anything to do, and this is not interesting. The problem is finding enough hours in the day and enough energy and capacity to keep going. I have family all around, so that's one way of relaxing and have a garden and spend time outdoors. And I'm also very interested in music, and I sing in a big classical chorus here in Boston, and that's a very demanding chorus and very challenging. My musical training is mediocre or non-existent, but I have been singing choral work for a long time. So that's a lot of fun, too. And that just gives me, you know, a break from what's the next book and what am I going to do? What do we need to do now to reach more people and get more of this the technology is changing so fast. From we have so many people now mm-hmm. doing this kind of thing that we're learning new ways to do it, new things to do with it all the time. And that's fascinating. I'm still just as interested as I was the day I first pick up a whistle and a bucket of fish.
When you have to, how do you calm yourself down?
That's a good question. Exercise and no caffeine. And Sudoku. I do a lot of Sudoku. Little logic puzzles. And I read a lot. But I don't read anything serious after 6 o'clock.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, of course. Have you ever been really broke with 3 kids to raise? My first divorce was a challenge. I think everybody's had hard times, you know, at one point or another. Mm-hmm. So I don't think of things that way. You know, once you get come out the other side, oh, good. That's done. We'll go do something else.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would be your best advice? What would you say?
Well, you know, I did that once for high school. Back in Hawaii, they asked me to give a commencement address, and I thought about what I would advise people to do, and unfortunately, some of the advice I gave infuriated the headmaster. He was very, very upset. I think 2 things to do. One is don't be afraid of hard work. You know, hey, just get it done. Get it out of the way. Life doesn't get easier. There's always hard work, and it's just part of life. So, but I think going to college, as I've got 3 grandchildren, 4 in college now. And if I were to give, they're all terribly hard workers. They're self-starters. That's not a problem. I guess if I had to give somebody that advice, it would be, first of all, find professors that you find interesting. It almost doesn't matter what the subject is. If you've got a great teacher in medieval English literature, then take that course. If you've got a great teacher in physics, drop in and eavesdrop and listen to a lecture or two, and find professors you can really look forward to spending several hours a week listening to. Because those are the people that, you know, will take you under their wing, too, and educate you. And be prepared to change topics and change ship or experiment outside your business goals. The more weird stuff you take, the more completely off the track stuff you take, the better education you'll get. Now, that's just the kind of advice that people don't want to hear, so.
Well, I think that's the purpose of college, is to go do those kinds of things that you can't experience any other time in your life.
That's right. That's absolutely true. You know, yes, I did a lot of theater in college, mm-hmm. and I didn't do it for any reason other than that it was a hilarious amount of fun, and the people that were doing it were the most fun group in town. and it stood me in good stead my entire life. You know, I spent a lot of time starting with writing and putting on those dolphin shows. I mean, they had to be shows. It was a good thing. Somebody knew that a show has to have a beginning and a middle and an end and a high point.
That's true.
They're still out at Sea Life Park. They are still running the shows I wrote in 1963.
Wow.
Yeah, I think they could have found something better by now, but apparently they still work.
If it works, it works.
I guess so.
What was your first book? Was it Don't Shoot the Dog?
No, my first book was called Nursing Your Baby, and it was a book for mothers. It came out in 63. It was a time when I wrote it because I was having my babies, and I discovered that. I discovered that the medical care that mothers got in those days was harmful to normal breastfeeding. And that also that it was something you had to learn how to do. You and the baby had to learn it together. And we didn't have any way of learning. We didn't have other mothers around us. We didn't have the tribal environment where you would have grown up watching mothers nursing and taking care of their babies. We were all sadly adrift, and the medical profession made it worse, not better. I mean, as a whole, they were idiots about normal breastfeeding too, because they never saw them. They were, you know, it was big bottle feeding time. And so I was going to graduate school. My husband was in graduate school in marine zoology, and I was taking one course a week or so with him. That put me in on the campus with a big research library. So I thought, it can't be what they're telling me, that modern mothers are too nervous or to breastfeed or something. You know, I mean, this is biologically impossible. We wouldn't be a species. We wouldn't be alive if we couldn't do this. So I started researching it, and I found out, sure enough, you know, what the problems were. So I wrote a book that covers, it's not so much a do-it-yourself book as a survey for moms, so that you know about the physiology, and you know about the behavior, and you know about the instincts, and you know about the amazing qualities of human milk and all this stuff, different chapters. And also, month by month, here's what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And the book has sold about 2 million copies over the years. It's still in print. My daughter, Gail, brought it up to date, not once, but twice. So now she's it's her book now, sort of passed on to family business, you know. But that was my first attempt to explain something that I understood, that I thought everybody else ought to understand. Don't Shoot the Dog was my third book, actually. That's the best known in the operant field. Before that, I wrote a book about my own experiences with the dolphins called Lads Before the Wind, a quote from Herman Melville. These are the Lads Before the Wind, which sold like two copies. But it's still in print too, because it's more of an adventure story than it is anything else. It's really, you will really know some dolphins when you've finished reading it. And it's somehow it has stayed in print ever since.
Wow. You have a good record as a writer.
Very few books, but they have lots of legs, as they say in publishing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I think Reaching the Animal Mind is going to go on forever, too. And that's the first one that started out with some decent sales. Speaking as what writers like to talk about, of course, is their agents and their publishers and how awful everything is.
Well, yes.
Bad jackets and bad contracts and stuff like that. But I had a wonderful editor on this book and a wonderful agent. And I'm sure there's another book down the road, but I'm trying not to think about it because the book is an awful lot of work.
My last question is to help me get better at this process. Think of a story that you haven't told me. What should I have asked you to tell me that story?
Oh, I have thousands of stories. Go and read Reaching the Animal Mind. That's a big storybook. But you know what interests me right now? I'll tell you what interests me right at this moment. Every year at Clicker Expo, we have 15 speakers and we give 45 one-and-a-half-hour lectures over the course of the 3 days. You have a big, wide range of stuff. It's sort of like TED on steroids, you know?
Yes.
I love the TED speeches, but this is kind of the same model. You can go to hear all these different things. And I always do one. I used to do more, but now, thank God, I only have to do one. And I was thinking about creativity because my first important scientific paper was called The Creative Porpoise Training for Novel Behavior. It was the result of an experiment we did at Sea Life Park in which we taught the animal to do something new each time. Each time we came and asked for something new, and the animal, the dolphin, actually caught on to this. So that game has become very popular with not so much dog trainers, but dog trainers too. The dog trainers put a box on the floor and click the dog for interacting with the box and doing something new each time. And in zoos, it's very popular for gorillas, they call it, show me something new. Because gorillas get bored, and particularly adolescent male gorillas, when bored, become juvenile delinquent adolescent male gorillas. You know, they get into all kinds of trouble. So this is a game that kind of gives them something to think about. Well, we have a very clear idea of what's necessary for teaching that. And last summer, a graduate student working in neuroscientist at Harvard, graduate students, group of them, I'd been working with them, teaching them how to train their rats because, you know, they asked me. And it seems to me that very seldom do neuroscientists actually know how to teach their rats what they want.
Yes.
They don't seem to get it. left. They're missing the boat. They're doing it all with Pavlovian, and hey, that's really hard on the rats. Anyway, she wanted to train rats to be creative, and in a week of training, we got quite close. So I was thinking, what do you have to have? And what does this rat need to know in advance? And what does the trainer need to know in advance? Well, you need to be used to experimenting and having new experiences and stuff. And I realized these things are all true for people. So what I'm wondering is, why don't we set it up for ourselves when we want to be creative to support that desire through setting up the training just exactly the way I would for a gorilla or a dolphin or a rat, giving the opportunity to explore without punishment for a start. You know, we're always terribly punished for doing unexpected things.
It does seem like people have difficulty not punishing ourselves.
Yeah, we do. That's very true. I think it's the fault of religion myself.
I don't know if you can blame bad coaching on religion, but it seems to me that coaches do that a lot too.
I know. No, you can't. But that, it's so much in the culture. I think it's also, when you think about the coaches, I think it comes from being primates. We really care about being the top primate. And if some other little baby primate gets in our way, or if some other adult primate gets in our way, and we are, let us say, a chimpanzee or a gorilla, and asking politely doesn't work, then we immediately escalate to aggression.
Yeah.
And then the other animal flinches and stuff, and that's a little reinforcing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you don't have another set of tools, you tend to fall back on being a primate.
Yes. I think it's really lack of theory.
Yeah.
If you don't know how you can reward people for specific changes in behavior, then all you do is yell at them. And if they get better, then you say, see, it worked.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. And if you do, it's not just rewarding them. Also, you need to know how to control yourself so that you don't expect too much. You break behavior down into small steps so that you can get one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
The pervasive sin of coaches is what we call better but. Well, that was better, but now you should be doing this and this and this, you know, instead of just saying, that was good, and let it alone. Leave it alone. Walk away from it. Let the animal go, oh, it was good. Thank you. What was it? Oh, yeah, that. Let them be. So there's a lot to the technology that doesn't exist in that is a little counterintuitive, and for which we have no textbooks, because, alas, the behavior analysis group, who really know more about this stuff than most people, they kind of junked shaping and the conditioned reinforcer. And those are the two big tools that are missing from everybody's textbook.
Yes. I teach personality, so I wrote a theory of personality just to give my students something to, you know, as an example of how you would go about writing one.
Interesting.
It has no real value other than that. But I called it Animals Plus, because as people, we like to emphasize the plus part, the cognitive part, the thinking part, the memory part, but we forget that we're basically animals that are really pushed a lot by operant conditioning much more than we would like to think we are.
Well, by operant conditioning and also by hormones and genetics and innate behavior, all this stuff like, you know, your face turning red when you're mad.
Yes.
We see that, you know, we kind of ignore the operant conditioning because it's counterintuitive and we don't know it's happening. And then we feel, oh my God, I'm being secretly controlled. That's why, I guess, where the big alarms all came from. But you are anyway, so get over it.
At least you should be able to control yourself.
You can always walk away from contingencies you don't like.
That's right.
Yeah.
In fact, that seems like one of the values of training large animals is that you can't pick them up and force them to do things. You're forced to use the good theory.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. And it allowed us, instead of just leaving them untrained and confined, but with no interaction, that's basically been the zoo policy for years.
Mm-hmm.
Just leave them alone. If you have to doctor them, well, you know you have to do it by brute force.
Yes. Well, knock them out.
Knock them out, absolutely, or squeeze cage. That's another bad idea.
Yeah.
And now we can doctor them by calling them over and saying, I want to give you a shot. Please give me your shoulder. Okay, here's a cookie. And the hyena goes, oh, you want to draw blood and presents its jugular vein. That's just an awesome thing. But through the bars.
Yeah.
Yeah, this opens up a whole lot of new thoughts about how do you deal with, you know, really dangerous humans, for example. What do you do? I mean, there's just a lot to think about because now we have some actual recipes that we didn't have before.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's limits to the number of reinforcers that we have available for us, but there's still a lot that we can do.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just a lot.
I want to thank Karen Pryor for being with me today. Thanks, Karen. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're most welcome, and good luck to you and all your students. I'm sure you're very reinforcing in the class.
Well, I click them every once in a while.
Laughing at their jokes works, too.
Hey, that's great. That's true. Thanks, Karen.
Okay.